Birth By, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. Joined in the studio, my office today, by Peter Hermanson, my co-host, and a very special guest we have with us today, Dr. James Henkel. We'll introduce him in just a moment. Today, we're going to be talking about disease. So any hypochondriacs out there, you will want to listen in, and then I suppose find a mirror and a shower.
Find the hazmat suit now.
As soon after as possible. We might ruin a few things for you. We'll see. Maybe some foods. But we'll be talking about disease and the work that Dr. James Henkel does, and then maybe get into a little bit about how this might impact the Christian, especially with our scripture narrative. With that being said, we might want to explain just briefly, Ben is not with us again this week, and that's not so far as I know because he's protesting anything or because he's decided to break up with us. But he has been extremely busy with work. This is the busy part of the year for him. So we look forward to getting him back, and he's still working behind the scenes on the episodes for us, for which we are very grateful. But some of you might be wondering, where is Ben? And Ben is Ben working and being a father and things of that nature.
Although he is a borderline millennial, and I don't know how they break up, but maybe this is how it happens.
Yeah, this might be where they just stop talking. Maybe I don't have an Instagram or whatever. Maybe he would send one of those, and don't.
Maybe he's tweeted at us, and we don't even know.
That's true.
Ben, if you're listening.
Yeah, Ben, if you're listening, I know how to use Facebook and in email or text if you'd like to just.
Or he lives a few blocks away. You could just walk over.
That is true. You do live 5 blocks from me. We could maybe just run into each other. But that being said, then why don't we get a little bit of a background from our guest? We've kept him waiting a little bit today, and he's been very gracious. Dr. James Henkel, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and the work that you do?
Sure. I've taught here for about, I'm starting in my sixth year, but before that I was a researcher in chlamydia, and I still research chlamydia. I'm a pathogenic microbiologist.
And I'll just point out that Jim's shirt says chlamydia is not a flower.
And it has two stick people, or kind of stick people, and one of them's holding a flower. The other one doesn't look interested.
I consider it a public service announcement. Anytime I wear it, especially in Baltimore.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I'll let you keep going. So you work in chlamydia?
Yeah.
And we'll let you continue from there?
Sure. I work on pathogenic bacteria and figuring out how they infect the body and how they infect cells. Sometimes that's with toxins. That's what my graduate research was in is bacterial toxins, which is fascinating. But I went to a little bit harder of a topic, if that could be had, and went into chlamydia. And oddly enough, I was working on a naval military base for a while and making radioactive chlamydia. And now I don't work on radioactive chlamydia anymore, but I work on chlamydia in general and some vitamin resource management by the chlamydia.
I can't say I understand what radioactive chlamydia is, but I'm glad you're not working on it anymore. I feel like the world may be a better place the less radioactive chlamydia we have.
Well, it was quite a challenge to make it, let me tell you. But I succeeded, and I'm proud of that fact.
Well, just please don't bring it with you.
I promise nothing.
Jim, if you don't mind me calling you Jim for the purpose of the podcast, has been here at the college 3 more years than me, so a wily veteran, but a colleague. I've been very excited to get into the office. Later we'll mention the glowing room I've talked about.
Yes.
He mentioned that to me when we were talking earlier. We can explain what exactly that is, and then apparently I had the wrong glowing room in mind. So we'll work our way back to that if we remember. But with that, why don't we share our disclaimer, and we will make our way to the scripture narrative.
And before a disclaimer, we should just say thank you to all our listeners out there. And if you're enjoying the show, make sure to share it with your friends. Subscribe, rate, review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I owe Peter an apology. I've written this down each week, and I keep forgetting to say that. So, yeah.
But we really do appreciate it.
We do.
We appreciate
subscribe,
listeners.
Rate, review, do all of that. We will we'll note by the time this is out, this is 2 podcasts away. But we have been with school picking up and work picking up for Peter and Ben and me actually having to start to work again with summer winding down. Falling a little bit behind, we do apologize for that, but we are getting some episodes in the hopper and we will be more regular hopefully coming up here. We're working on a little bit, figuring out some more of the tech side so we can all chip in a little bit more with that. And so don't worry if we missed a week, if you notice that, we will be getting back at it. And so please do, as we do so, give us a nice push by, as Peter said, and I was supposed to say, subscribing, rating, reviewing. It does do us a great assistance or service as we try to grow the conversation. With that in mind, then, the disclaimer. First off, you all now have chlamydia. I'm just joking. It cannot be infected through the podcast, as far as I know. You may want to wash your computers, your phones, whatever devices you are listening on, probably dunk them in water, some sort of bleach maybe.
It's a good policy.
Okay, so
make sure to leave them in there for a good, 10 minutes at least.
Yeah. But our disclaimer then, this show doesn't speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers. To be honest, much of the time it probably doesn't speak for us. We will be thinking out loud a lot. So approach what you hear with a healthy skepticism because, well, as a responsible resident of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you were just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live free, friends, and don't let us get in the way. We've been in Matthew quite a lot lately. I guess maybe subconsciously I'm trying not to offend him or myself by using John or Mark.
Matthew, the safe gospel.
The safe gospel, yeah. And so we're going to fall back on good old Matthew. He's making a comeback here on Let the Bird Fly. And this account is from Matthew chapter 8, 1 through 4. And it's a shorter account, so I will go ahead and read it for you. When Jesus came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said. "Be clean." Immediately he was cleansed of his leprosy. Then Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." I picked this account for a few reasons, but one of them being the mention of leprosy, which we'll be talking about a little more with Dr. Henkel. He has some interesting insights on that when we get to the main topic for the day. But the second that I think is always fascinating to me with these accounts is that language of clean and unclean. And if you're familiar with the Old Testament, that's great. If you're not, I'll just give you a little background. This is a theme throughout the Old Testament, clean or unclean. You have foods that are clean or unclean. You have diseases or actions that can make you clean or unclean. You have bodily events that can make you clean or unclean. All of these things that come into play that factor in. And so we might read this account and just hear that you can make me clean and simply hear a plea for physical healing. But for this man and for his life, there's a lot more caught up in that. Surely he's asking to be healed of his leprosy, but he's also being asked asking to be restored in a whole host of ways. The leper at this time was, in essence, quarantined from society, was shut off from family and from friends, and lived a life in which he was required to make people aware of his uncleanliness. This was a very smart thing societally to do, even having to go to show yourself to the priest to make sure someone was healed before they went back into the community. This was meant to protect the community, but it also isolated one. You became the other or another, and you were shut off from all the things that maybe before this had given you identity. You were even shut off from the key events of the worship life or the liturgical life of your community. And so to be unclean meant to be sick, but it also meant maybe what you felt like in middle school when you didn't have a table to sit at in the cafeteria. Or maybe those of you who have gone through marital issues when you were at your low, what that felt like. Or professionally, when you've lost your job that you've had for a long time and in which you found great pride and joy and a sense of self. When he comes and he says, "You can make me clean," there's so much caught up in this. And so Jesus restores this man, and he, in essence, gives him back his life. And those of you who have listened now for a while will get where that fits with what we do on the podcast. Those of you who haven't, go back and listen and subscribe, rate, and review. But as you'll do, you'll notice our whole theme is living freely in a world given back to us. In our first scripture narrative, if I'm remembering, Peter was from the great Gospel of Mark, chapter 5, the demoniac who was healed and restored, and now he's the only sane man in town.
That's right. That's when you tried to stack the deck against all other Gospels, right?
That, I believe that's when it started. But think of, for this leper, all that was being given back to him, all these things he thought he might never enjoy again, whether that be family or friends, food and drink, the liturgical life of the church, things of this nature, all given back as gift, and how those things surely were received in a way they would not have been had he never been unclean. And in essence, what Christ has come to do for us as Christians is to declare us clean, and he does that in holy baptism, where with water we are declared to be a child of God. He does that through absolution and the preaching of the gospel. He does that in the sacrament, where he feeds us and says, "You are my family. Take a seat at my table." And then he sends us out to rejoice and to serve our neighbor in a world given back to us. So we'll be talking a little bit about disease, leprosy, a little bit of chlamydia, as Dr. Henkel mentioned, things of this nature in this episode. But as we do so, I hope we can keep in mind how even in the midst of those things, we have a God who works, who is active. And no, he might not heal us all of everything, although many of us receive marvelous healing. And it's important to remember then, too, I thought about using the account of Naaman, who's told to go wash in the river. Oftentimes, he will do this through means. Maybe I don't sit on my couch and just pray and wait. Maybe I go to the doctor and I'm healed of things that at this point, like leprosy, you know, would have been fatal. That just as he works through word and sacrament, God oftentimes works through means for our good as well. I sometimes will show my students my asthma inhaler and say, without this thing, I would be in a very bad way since my childhood. And God has worked through this little means, this little puffer, for my benefit, and how I can take that for granted. So to remember, too, how God is working for you through means to bring healing, but ultimately how he will restore us in life eternal when, through death itself, which he's conquered, the ultimate killer, death, he will bring us to life eternal and perfect life, too. So I don't want to get too much on the bully pulpit today, but hopefully that brings us into our theme. And Peter, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I thought I heard you say, when I go to the doctor. And I was just wondering, do you actually go to a doctor?
I do go to the allergy. I go to the allergy doctor. I don't like doctors. I haven't been to a real doctor.
And no offense, allergy doctor.
I don't know that I don't think I've been to a regular doctor since I got married and was off my parents' insurance. I've done like the Walgreens physical, I think, like when it was required or something. But no, I'll admit, I'm terrified. I've told my wife I never want tubes put in me, anything like this, and she sometimes gets bothered by that. I might have mentioned that on the podcast before. I've thought maybe I should go to one, you know, but I also feel like I should get in shape before I go, because I don't want to go and just be told all the things I got to work on.
Yes, that is.
Because I feel like it'd be a black mark on my record. So it's not official. I'm not officially overweight or have heartburn or whatever else until I go in and they say so. So yeah, I appreciate these means. I suppose an equivalent could be I'm neglecting the sacrament of sorts. At this point, Peter might throw in I wasn't in church this morning, but I am going tomorrow night. This is maybe a good reminder to me that I should go to doctors. The other thing is, though, the doctor's office is full of sick people, right?
That's right.
Much like the church. And so, you know, I don't want to go and take time that they could be getting with the doctor. You know, it's not that I don't want to get sick from them.
Yeah.
It just, I feel like, you know, you go to the ER and somebody's missing like an eye or something, and then you're like, my foot hurts. And
they're like, you got an ingrown toenail.
Right. Or, you know, just deal with it.
It's
very
altruistic.
Yeah. So it's mostly just
all kinds of ways of justifying reactions.
The love I have for my neighbor.
Yeah.
I suppose with that, we'll make our way to the free-for-all.
Do you have a position? Well, first of all, are you a baseball fan? Or are you aware of the sport at all?
I have inherited baseball fever from my wife and her family.
Okay.
So I take the kids to games. I enjoy it. I am learning all the things that they obviously know, so I seem like an idiot, but... yeah, it's fun. I like going.
I think you'll have a more informed answer than our guest from a number of episodes back, Dr. Kerry Keene. he was wondering if the designated hitter kicked the ball through the goalposts or something like that. So,
yeah.
No, our question, though, we've asked a number of our guests is, what is your opinion on the designated hitter versus the pitch you're hitting? Which one is better and why?
Well, I'll tell you both sides of our little civil war in our family. My wife is all for the designated hitter.
Sounds lovely.
I'm against it just because if you're going to play the game, you should be playing all the parts and not be a wimp about one part. But I do understand that things are sped up in some ways. But I've been called a Neanderthal in the past, so I'm going to go a very simplistic answer. And my wife, yeah, she's the more cultured, shall we say, and more educated person, the smarter of the two.
See, I like this because this is adding sophistication to the DH, which I think some of you have tried to take away from me. So.
We'll start playing some classical music behind the discussion here.
Yeah. That brings up the main free-for-all we were kind of going to get to now that we've solved this, and I like how it worked out, and I'm glad Peter brought it up, it'll be a couple weeks ago now when you're listening to this, likely, but last night was the Conor McGregor and Floyd Mayweather fight. And I think I'm the only one in the room who watched it, and I'm not going to share how I watched it, but I was able to see it. After, I think, I missed the first, second, maybe third round. But I'm curious to just get thoughts on a couple things. First, Jim...
So before we go any farther, there might be some listeners who aren't familiar with Mayweather and McGregor. Do you want to explain
what this
fight is?
So Conor McGregor is a mixed martial arts fighter. I believe he's done all his fighting in the UFC or the equivalent of it. And I can't remember who challenged who, but it became an issue of could McGregor, a UFC fighter, beat Mayweather, who is a boxer, who is now 50-0 and had been 49-0, who, by the way, is from Michigan, my home state, although I was not pulling for him in the fight. And so... The draw of the fight was McGregor was going to have to, I would say, and Jim will have better input on this, kind of pare down his fighting and technique and style in order to box Mayweather. And so the fight happened last night. It went 10 rounds. I thought McGregor came out pretty well at first, but clearly kind of became tired. It was kind of controversial. 10th round, they stopped it with a TKO. I'll admit, I think boxing is more rigged than the NBA, and I think the NBA is pretty rigged. So I'm suspicious if there was some deal to let it go 10 rounds and then end in a way that everybody could save face. But at that point, McGregor clearly, one of the things in boxing that may be different from other fighting is, if you go a minute without getting your hands up, the referee is looking at that, noticing that. And he was having a harder time defending himself. I think very impressive to go 10 rounds with who is... the man who's viewed as the best boxer in the world today. But so the big thing was this is a mixed martial artist fighting a boxer. And I think some have said, well, if Mayweather went and fought McGregor, it'd be over in 30 seconds. And I think that might be true. A comparison I made with friends is it's kind of like going from Latin to Greek or from Latin to Hebrew.
Yeah.
To go from MMA to boxing is to is to pare down technique and have to learn highly specialized things. And then to go, which would be to me like Latin and Greek, you know, and then to go from boxing to MMA would just be an astounding amount of stuff to learn. There's just so much more that factors in to what happens. And so,
like, there's twice as many corners, for instance, in the ring.
Well,
right?
Yeah, and I mean, you're kicking. You can get the other guy down. Things of this nature. And when you're down, you have him down. You can beat
ground
on him.
Ground
you
know? And pound.
Yeah. But Jim, you actually we always have at the beginning of the year Provost Days, and it comes up different things about campus. And one
I
of the
see
things,
the connection already. We've got mixed martial artists, Provost Day. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that always comes up is campus security. And I know one of the things that Jim has offered for colleagues here is you do – it's Taekwondo, right?
Yeah.
And so maybe a little bit of your background with that and then your thoughts on an MMA fighter versus a boxer or anything connected to that.
Sure. I'm a sixth-degree black belt in Taekwondo. My whole family, all four of us, are sixth-degree black belts, so it makes it interesting when you want to hug your mom and she tries a new technique on you. But it's a nice family sport, and it's you can have a lot of impact on it. So you learn how to take a hit, and you have fast reaction time. Is it always realistic for self-defense? No. But very few martial arts are, so you always have to kind of cover your the chinks in your armor. I always talk about that are the gaps. So cross training is always good, but I always like the Taekwondo as a base because you're moving on your feet. You're thinking about zones of defense away from you, so you have and you're moving quickly and not trying to take the hit. And I'm really against getting on the ground, but when I teach self-defense, I teach them enough Brazilian jiu-jitsu and stuff, the very little I know, to hurt them on the way down, don't get hurt yourself, and hurt them on the way back up because it's a self-defense situation. But it isn't like we have a fight club on campus, but yeah.
If there were a fight club, the first rule would preclude telling us
I'm denying a fight club.
Which pretty much affirms that there is a fight club, right?
I'm denying the fight club.
when we get called into the provost office now tomorrow, we'll know why. You said something interesting with that. And, you know, I don't know. I did karate as a kid, and I don't know. You know, I think I did 2 years of it, and then would go home, and my brother and I would use it on each other. You know?
Of course. That's how it is.
Yeah, I think my mom had to stop because of that. I mostly was trained in the WWF as a child, which I have a feeling would not translate that
elbow.
Well in self-defense. So Taekwondo is you don't want to get down on the ground. I know lot of the UFC fighters are trained in multiple arts, and so you have the jiu-jitsu. That would be is that the main art they're using for once it gets they're down on the ground fighting?
Yeah, a lot of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Some people come from a judo background, but it's most in some like. Serious wrestling, but it's usually Brazilian jiu-jitsu with the joint manipulations and such on the ground. I guess it's really important to remember that all these are kind of artificial in some way. In the MMA, you're training to fight another martial artist. It does give you a lot of variability and gives you the ability to fight on the ground, but that's the last place you want to stay is on the ground because a lot of bad guys are smart and they have backup waiting to test the wind for that extra point on your head while you're down and people carry knives too, so I teach them just enough to get off the ground but not feel comfortable there.
I like that now we've scared people with disease and knife attacks.
I will point out that there are clear signs on all the buildings on campus, so there are no knives or guns on campus because there are signs that preclude
such.
Yes,
it's clearly prohibited.
Things, right?
Yes, and okay. I feel safer for it.
Yeah. Now, if you one of the things that's interesting to me in this, after the fight, McGregor had said something along the lines of, I made him fight like a Mexican. And some people got upset and said, oh, this is racist. But then people who know boxing came out and said, no, this is a Mexican style of boxing. What he meant was he made Mayweather come off the defensive, which Mayweather usually does. He's on the defensive. Yeah. He's going to wear you down, absorb blows, hug a lot. And Mayweather actually had to go on the attack. And so I'm not going to get into is that a bad remark to make or what. But one of the things that was interesting to me is McGregor was clearly was clearly referring to a style.
Yes.
And Peter, you mentioned earlier you watched a UFC fight once with guys at a bar, and you know you can only watch so much before you kind of had to turn away. And I'll admit, some of the times when it gets to, I get real. It's kind of like, this is gonna sound bad. Like you watch like. You know, sometimes I'll watch, like, a riot might break out. Like, you're watching the news, and it's like, a riot might break out. And part of you, and this is my sinful nature, is like, oh, I got to stay up in case a riot breaks out. Well, why would I want to watch it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But then if it does, then I'm all freaked out. Like, no, those people there, this is terrible, you know. And I see that sometimes with combat sports where I'm like, and even with in football, and I love football, but the big hit now as I get older, I'm kind of like, wow, that was really dangerous, you know.
Yeah.
I think what's fascinating about it is there clearly is artistry and a lot of cerebral things that factor into this. My former Paris, some of my members were very interested in UFC, and they actually, you know, did some of it in practice, and a couple were very accomplished wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd listen to them, and it was like they were talking about a painting or a piece of music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting first article thing about life in this world is that, you know, even this combat, you know, which is not when it's done for artistry, not when it's done, you know, to knife fight someone. I think knife fighting's always wrong, to be clear, unless it's self-defense, obviously. But
the Milwaukee Police Department would agree with you, too.
But is there anything that stands out to you, whether it be with taekwondo or anything else, that just you find your mind being challenged as much as your body?
Oh, absolutely. As I'm trying to get back in shape for the first time in my adult life, I'm starting to realize that it actually is hard, and it is mind over matter. I personally find that as you get higher in rank, you're doing more and more things. I always have my students break boards to show mastery over a technique.
Now, are those real boards? I've always
wondered. They are. They're inch or 0.75.
Okay.
I've always been told that they're equivalent to human rib. I haven't tested that yet, but I'm going to work with Dr. Ned Farley to try to test that in some ways. Not on a human,
I was going to say, was he your subject in this test?
No. But we've talked about different ways to measure it because he does the forensic.
Dead ribs you're talking about, not living
sure,
ribs.
Sure, yes. Yeah.
All right.
Yes. But, yeah, no.
Makes me hungry. I'm thinking of ribs now.
Yeah.
We were talking about that cannibal guy the last episode, Peter, which hasn't come out yet, but Will, so you got to be careful with that.
Yeah. No, I always like challenging myself now, not only with fighting, but I don't get to spar as much as I want, so I kind of lose some of my skill there with the black belts, but I like breaking boards. It's fun. It's challenging. You look at a piece of wood and go, or another material and say, can you break that? How would I do that? Currently, I was going to test for my seventh dan black belt, and I'm not sure if that's going to happen due to technicalities, but I was looking at doing a very difficult plank break, like a 4-foot plank and splitting it lengthwise, and I think I can do it. My dad says it's against the laws of physics, which makes me want to do it more.
We need Dr. Keen.
Yeah, well, I am going to talk to him about it, but it's also difficult because of the kick itself. But, yeah, you can go bigger, thicker boards. I break 2x12s regularly just because they're fun.
Uh-huh.
But there's this it's a fun challenge. And another kind of mental thing is when somebody's kicking you, everything else goes away. You have to focus on that foot coming up at your face. Otherwise, things go wrong.
Yeah.
So,
and I imagine it, you know, somewhat like chess even, if you are sparring with someone, or similar to football, you have to try to know your opponent to be a couple moves ahead.
Yep.
Not, you know, because where ultimately is your opponent trying to take you, things of this nature. And
yeah, a lot of times time seems to slow down if you've gotten to a certain level and You're kind of trying to set them up so you twitch one way or bring up your knee, seeing if they can move their feet one way so you can get a nice kick the second time or the third time. Or I just like playing mental games now. People get really upset if they have their guard up and you're still kicking them. I mean, in all good Christian love and without right. harming them because of the chest protectors, but it really gets to them, huh. and it makes me happy.
Yeah.
I know it sounds bad, but it's fun to make people understand that they're not as protected as they might seem.
Yeah.
And it's easier with males because males seem to think that they can do a headbutt and get away. And
like Glasgow Kiss.
Yeah, or the Wisconsinite Shake or something.
Yeah, it was fun to see that with the fight. In the early rounds when McGregor really came out hard, you could tell the footwork and things of that nature and just the fact that he was boxing differently than what Mayweather would be used to.
Yeah.
You know, it was interesting to see that kind of taking or coming into effect. Peter, before we go too long with the free for all, any thoughts you have on? Do you have any history of any martial arts or interest or any thoughts on the match?
No, I didn't watch it. I knew it was happening, but I didn't watch it, and I don't pay too close attention. As you mentioned, Wade, I saw mixed martial arts fight, you know, pay per view. Went to a bar with a friend of mine from graduate school. He said, "Hey, it's gonna be great." And in fact, I think he listens to the podcast, so he'll know who I'm talking about. And I remember watching the first couple of fights before the premiere of the feature, or whatever it was. And I thought, well, I don't know if I could make it through all of these. It was I did appreciate the the brute force of it, and I appreciated the art behind it, but at the same time, that's a lot of blood. It's like, yeah, it was tough to get over that. When I was in grade school, I have a cousin who he got into stick fighting, just Ooh. Like in his front yard with his friends. Oh. And he was older than me and older than his younger brother, who is a year younger than I am. And so he would get us in the ring with him, and then he'd beat the tar out of us.
Yeah, we used to box, and my buddy got boxing gloves, and then we had no training, and it just became brutal. Yeah.
No, and he'd turn on something Welcome to the Jungle and blast it, and then he'd just start pounding on his
Enter
brother.
Sandman.
Yeah. Fortunately, I was the cousin, so I'd get tapped out pretty quickly, but his brother was merciless, so
the boys, and we're gonna go too long with this, so I should stop, but the boys, when we moved to Wisconsin, wrestling is just bigger in Wisconsin than it was in Michigan. And I mean, there's high school wrestling is pretty big in Michigan, but like grade school wrestling in Wisconsin even is very, very big. And so the boys they wrestled for a year, and they did pretty well. I mean, they held their own. And the school they're at, the three schools combined for the program, and really good coaching, and they learned a lot. But it was, of all the sporting events I've been to, like the most nervous I've ever been. You know, you're sitting outside the circle watching, these kids, really struggling against each other. But one of the things I also appreciate about it is there was more crying than any other sporting event I've ever been to, but not bad crying. When a kid lost, he'd come off for a while. He'd be crying. He's upset he lost, maybe, or maybe he's a little bit hurt. But it was just him working through it, right? Mm. That he couldn't, it's not like baseball or softball where he could say, oh, the team really didn't do whatever. They processed it. And I've seen a lot of kids, especially personality types, that's really beneficial for, that they are learning then, and maybe they're working through other things at home, whatever the case may be, but this actually almost becomes like a therapeutic thing too, of you're working through, you step in, and now there's rules to this, and there's judges and coaches, so there's a structure, but you're working through something that you just did.
And in the end, I never wrestled, but when I would, back...
Let's wrestle right now.
I'm not in your weight class.
That's true. Give me a week.
When I wrestled, like backyard wrestling, when I would go up against someone who had just wrestled for even just a year or two, it was just unbelievable. I couldn't, couldn't even begin. And so I was always amazed by that. But the thing about wrestling is it's an individual sport, obviously. You're working by yourself on the mat. But when you lose, you lose. I mean, you're getting pinned and you are physically, it's not like in tennis, which is an individual sport, or golf, you lose and you can say, well, I slipped or, whatever. This is the other person physically holding you down in a position where
you are. And everybody's seeing it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I can understand why that would, bring tears, but I can also understand why that might be a good thing. I mean, sorry, not to get too, theological on this, but isn't that where we should, where we are and we don't always recognize it? And that's, our sin should be pinning us down, right? And we don't recognize it. And when you do come to that moment, we talk about hitting rock bottom or something, it just kind of all hits you and you kind of have to deal with it. It's right in your face then. I don't know.
Maybe I really do think it was good for the boy. And the main reason they didn't do it again is they didn't like the clothes, And I think, But I think there also is the aspect of just it's extremely rigorous. I mean, it is a commitment to learn the holds and to do well. But I do think they benefited from it. Jim, anything else before we make our way to the main topic?
Well, just to reiterate, I totally agree with you. In Taekwondo, I used to teach at a YMCA under my master, Dr. Dwight Stevens. And some of the kids came in there pretty rough. They had things going on at home. You don't see as much return and responsiveness right away when they are not getting it reinforced at home, but it did help many of them. Girls and people working through things, they were able to release some anger in a very safe and positive way. And then they learned how to control it, because it's all about control. You can hit them as hard as you can, but you shouldn't.
Right.
And having that control is really important. And it helped me in a very difficult time in my life. And it was good. It was good.
Wade, maybe you should take some lessons from Dr. Hinkle. It might help with some of your anger problems.
Well, you know, I've actually thought about trying to learn something, because some of the Lutheran pastors out in the social media world or blogosphere, they're really into jiu-jitsu right now, and they've been speaking his praises. I'm a little nervous about just getting down on the ground and wrestling with a bunch of people when I'm sweaty and fat and bearded. But, but you know, I do enjoy going to the gym and lifting, but I do need to do something a little more.
The
yeah,
first,
thanks.
You could kick me. The first five kicks are free.
There you go. No, I think it would be something that could be fun. And I think if people do have questions about it, we maybe can link to Dr. Henkel's faculty page or something if they have questions. Maybe I'm sure he'd be happy to give some thoughts. Or if you want to message us on Facebook, that might be the best way, and we can let him know and get his thoughts. But
you can always email us at podcast@letthebirdfly.com.
Yeah, but before we do need to get back to chlamydia and leprosy, so why don't
we've been avoiding it.
Yeah, why don't we make our way into the main topic. I guess just to start off, our scripture narrative, Jim, was mentioned leprosy, and it's a theme that comes up in the Bible. And I think, you know, people in the pews probably hear it mentioned in the readings, and then they think, yeah, that probably wasn't pleasant. But any background or thoughts or work you've done or anything of that nature that you might shed a little light on this important sickness that shows up in the scriptures of leprosy?
Sure. We're not quite sure if all the times they talk about leprosy actually were leprosy in the Bible, and you know that, but it bears mentioning. Sometimes,
in other words, you're saying what they called it may not be what we would call it. This
exactly.
is a general term.
Yeah, the symptoms.
You're saying you can't trust Scripture? Is that?
No, that is not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we shouldn't misinterpret it.
I like that.
But with Mycobacterium, it starts, it's kind of innocuous at first. It grows slowly. It gets into the tissues. It destroys nerve endings, so you don't really feel that you're hurting yourself. So it kind of, there's more damage over time. Oddly enough, there's only two places in nature as of right now. I should probably research this a little bit more, but that we've actually identified where we can get it. And it's the pads of a certain type of field mouse and 13-banded armadillos or 9-banded armadillos. That's the only place we've ever been able to culture it. So that should probably be some kind of grad student's job is to go hunt down where it's living in life. But
and so these things can carry it without dying from it, or they're
correct. Okay. Yep. Yeah, as far as we know, yeah. Bats are another good example of an animal that can carry a lot of different diseases right. and not apparently be affected by many
which
of them.
Which is one of the animals I'm most terrified by. We used to get them in the parsonage and in the church, and I would have to shoot them with my BB gun.
Oh.
But was I'm just flying mice, you know? It just yeah. it and when they swoop down at you,
yeah.
it one of the churches in the area, they had the elders had tennis rackets because they would get them. And so they would, you know, you'd get it and you'd knock yeah. it. But, yeah, I just try to stay away from those. Armadillos I've never been afraid of, but now I'm a little concerned. So.
I've mostly seen armadillos on the roadside in Texas and Oklahoma. So they're usually pretty flat at that point. They don't bother me.
They're coming north.
Are
so,
they?
Yeah, we might start seeing them sooner rather than later.
Really?
Yeah.
Like people are bringing them north or they're just...
No, they're migrating north.
Huh.
Say what you will about... climate change or whatever, it's they're coming north, so they're now past St. Louis easily.
Wow. Well, is there any chance they would eat the Asian carp we're trying to keep out of
the wish. Yeah, that would be an epic fight. That would be a pay-per-view I would watch. But
tonight.
Yeah, tonight. Rumble. Yeah.
So you mentioned that the person with leprosy or with what they were calling leprosy at biblical times, for a while, they wouldn't even realize they have it, then, that they're carrying it.
Yeah.
When are they going to start to realize they have it?
Well, when they start having deadening of the nerves where they're running into things and not feeling it, or possibly slicing off a finger or heavily damaging something because they don't have those sensory nerves that are telling them they're not doing something right.
Which is an interesting thing of we always think of pain as a curse,
yeah.
but the importance of pain yep. sometimes is a blessing, too.
Yeah, it's there to tell us not to do that anymore. Or you're getting close to something really dangerous, or that's hot. Right. If you can't feel the heat, you're going to smell something like bacon burning sooner or later, and it's going to be you.
Yeah.
There would be damages. Sometimes it would cause the skin to be damaged. And these people would clearly be diseased, and that they would just come away clean from Jesus curing them is a bigger thing than just the bacterium going away. It's their whole body was restored then, clearly.
And this is, you think of the, you know, hold out your hand and the hand becomes, is restored. What, at the time... it seems the best they knew they could do was simply to quarantine these yep. lepers together. Is what is accounted for the lack of leprosy as described in the scriptures in the West today? Is there anything? Is it just general hygiene, or is there anything in particular that's been developed that has combated this, or it's, the environment is different? Or
Detection methods. Because we do have it here. In fact, there was a case of...
You don't mean on campus?
No, okay. Not on campus. I'm
not
saying
in
the
room
New World.
That you're...
Not in the blue room.
Okay.
And we'll have to talk about that. There's multiple emanating glows that we need to define here.
So we'll make our way back. So there's leprosy in the States, but not on campus that we know.
Yes, correct. We actually had some... Two Hispanic children in California that got it, but it's treatable now because we have the correct antibiotics.
Is that like Benadryl and Icy Hot, or
Jim,
treat about
Tiger Balm is
two.
Mine. Yeah.
Did you listen to the scripture narrative? I mean, it was treatable
with Jesus. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's a little bit different.
It's treatable in that it prevents further damage, or actually that you can it can be restorative.
No, it's remarkable how much can be restored. Huh. Now, the peripheral nervous system, to an extent, can regenerate over time, but even their face and the outlying skin, it can actually cause bubbles and. Horrid growths on their face, and I've seen pictures because you don't see it very much nowadays, of people who looked just horribly disfigured, and then, like, a year later, they are looking happy and healthy. They don't even see it.
Huh.
So it's rather remarkable how resilient the body is as long as it gives that upper hand.
Now, would that maybe brings us a little bit to to your work, and I'll admit, when I was on the co-curricular committee here at the college for a while, and I've had students who have presented at what we do. It's called the Undergraduate Research Seminar. Yeah. And one of the fun things that the college does, for its size, there's just an amazing amount of research that takes place here.
It is.
And especially where Dr. Henkel works in Generac in the building over there, the things that you all as professors are leading your students to do, I think are opportunities they wouldn't have many places.
Yeah.
And so a number of your students have presented at the research seminar, and so I usually try to sit in with the humanities stuff when I can, but sometimes
accidentally.
You know, yeah, they need someone to serve in there, or out of curiosity. I have a student in one of my classes who's presenting something in the sciences, not the queen of the sciences, theology, but the other sciences. one of the things I've learned is, so we mentioned chlamydia, and maybe people, if you've listened this far, maybe you heard it earlier, and you thought, why would anybody want to study chlamydia? Anybody who gets that, they must be sinning, whatever the case may be. obviously, Dr. Henkel was researching it to make it more radioactive and deadly. I'm just joking, but
it isn't naturally radioactive, just for anybody listening.
There we go. See, I don't know enough about it from there, but one of the things I learned that opened my eyes was how it impacts throughout the world, and that, you know, in many ways, I remember the one presentation, this is something that's can be spread through a group of children together, not washing their hair or rubbing their eyes.
Yep.
And the impact that this can have around the world. And I think from a Christian perspective, this is somewhat fascinating of, we just take for granted the health system we have here and the things that we deal with. Maybe if you could just explain a little bit, why should we care about chlamydia, how it affects people differently throughout the world, just why it should be on our radar as something that is a world problem.
Sure. Chlamydia, especially Chlamydia trachomatis, there's a number of different species that cause different diseases. There's one that causes pneumonia. Most everybody gets a form of that. I don't work on that one because it can be aerosolized, and that's not good. In the States, we think of the sexually transmitted version. And the reason that it's so prevalent, it's the number one bacterial STD. And the reason it is that it's so good at hiding. Upwards of 85 to 90% of the people who have it don't know they have it.
Huh.
So you don't get symptoms until it's too late.
Peter's itching his elbow. Is itching an elbow?
No, it is not. I am not, unless he has...
It's crawling all over now.
Chlamydia of the elbow, and I will write up a case study of that. Can I use your name?
So these that don't know they have it, they just go untreated?
Yeah, and then they spread it. Sometimes they'll find out years later that infertility is a major issue. I'm not saying that everybody who is infertile due to different things is because they had chlamydia. It's
right.
That it might be one of those things. Or
well,
you were saying
that Scripture is not inerrant earlier, right?
how did I come back on that? Yeah, no.
So this is something that, you know, can lead to repercussions
yes.
in the body that we
yes.
don't realize are taking place.
Yeah, until it's too late. And it can cause some dangerous symptoms such as... intervascular coagulation, where disseminated intervascular coagulation, or DIC, it's a very dangerous situation. Basically, everything coagulates, which is not good for life. But that's only in this country. Nobody cares about the STD as much in developing countries because they have a blindness that is caused. So you can get recurrent infections due to low hygiene. Some people, there was one paper in the 70s that kind of sort of proved that flies can transfer it to eyes. But in general, there's a lot of people who get recurrent infections in their eyelid, and it scars it, and then it starts turning in the eyelashes, so it scrapes against the cornea, and they get a blindness due to that, or at least an occlusion of their vision. And there's upwards of 8 million people that get this, and nobody in America seems to know about it.
Which is, you know what, that's probably the, about the population of New York City.
Yeah.
I mean, or what's...
Yeah, I'm not sure. I can look it up.
It's
about the probably the what I think Michigan's 9-10 million, Wisconsin's 5-6 million, but
yeah.
So a very substantial population.
Yeah.
That's probably not. I don't know. I mean, we can't take a poll of our listeners, but probably wasn't on many of their radar.
No.
What is being done about it? Is there any concerted effort being made?
The World Health Organization is always looking into ways to better treat these people, and if they need to bring. Ocular surgeons in to work on this because they need a corneal transplant at that point. They can't just kind of buff it out. But if they get it treated early enough and they don't get reoccurrence, it most likely won't kind of bend the eyelashes in. But it's mostly detection and treatment before it becomes that bad. But there's so many places where they get a doctor or only can go to the doctor once a year because it's quite a trek and it might be expensive or something, that and they might not even have the drugs that you need, which is very sad. It kind of really gets at me being a researcher. I sit in this lab, and it's all very academic, and then you see examples of these people far away that are getting horribly mistreated by this bacteria because you haven't figured out a cure yet or a better way to detect it or what have you. And it can be easily treated. Huh. All we need to do is get the drugs to that person. And there's many examples in infectious diseases where if we can only get the drugs or detect it further or give them a pure water source, they wouldn't have these things anymore. It's somewhat frustrating because you do the basic science and then sometimes nothing pans out. I mean, it's an interesting paper,
right. But
there isn't as much what we call translational science into it, where it goes out and does some good, like you came into the field to do, is to change the world. One of our previous students who was in my graduate lab, she always said that she wanted to save the world. And
not like Jesus.
But. No, in kind of a superhero way, though. she hasn't ever lost that optimism, and I think that's really neat. I'm not seeing as much saving of the world through science as there should be.
You know, that is one of the things we hit on a lot on the podcast is vocation, though. And I think that is something that's fascinating and important. One of the things I really appreciate the college and my colleagues who work in the sciences is the vocational aspect of it. You know, sometimes people will that we are a Lutheran college, a Christian college, and then you'll think of, people doing science there. And, you know, maybe people think of, what's the thing in Kentucky where they build the big ark or, whatever the case. And we're not going to get into that. But the fact is doing real science, and and we'll do an episode sometime where we do talk about evolution and how this model does work scientifically, but that doesn't mean you now throw out the scriptures and you
Correct.
Don't have your convictions, but that some things can be useful as you do science to serve your neighbor, and so that vocational aspect to it, I think, is something that is able to be offered at an institution like ours. That you're going into this not simply for what you might make at the end, which it is important to make something at the end. My wife will attest to, that I'm supposed to get paychecks, which is why first day of school tomorrow, I'm supposed to show up apparently and, teach or something.
Or whatever you call it.
Yeah. But I think an argument could be made. Maybe you're actually being pushed to do better or more faithful work as a scientist, too, when you recognize your neighbor is on the end of
yes.
what you're doing,
yeah.
When there's that 8 million number that you look at and say, how can we help serve these people? And maybe you can't cure everyone or whatever the case may be. And maybe your work is not finding a cure, but it's finding what isn't, right?
Yeah.
The process of elimination that sometimes can go with that, which I think, when we do philosophy, Peter, is very similar. Everybody's striving after the truth. And sometimes someone's going to do great work. And then centuries later, we say, well, it turns out this, he was wrong on, but someone needed to do that, and it took a great mind. We mentioned in previous discussion prior to the episode, and I've been thinking about this a lot because I've been since we started the podcast, I've wanted to have this talk because it does fascinate me. A book that some people might be interested in, and I'm not going to assume anybody's read it, but it's important for understanding history, is Guns, Germs, and Steel. And it looks at how those three things have just transformed the world. And in some ways transformed the world for bad, right? Mm-hmm. Some cultures had gunpowder for centuries. And then other cultures got it and realized, hey, we can shoot at each other now. And then they realized, hey, we can shoot at other people. And you have colonialism and these things which happen, which obviously...
I think my neighborhood growing up had that same, like, you know, process of revelation. Like, whoa. Look
yeah, I'm not thinking individuals. I'm thinking governments. But, you know, so you could have, you know, ills that come out of this as well. You know, the Industrial Revolution didn't necessarily work great for everyone right away. You know, I always have, like, a certain, like, sense of sympathy with the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. You know, not bombing people. I'm not advocating that. But, you know, went to U of M. As an MSU fan, I like to point out, went to University of Michigan. you know, he writes his manifesto, and he kind of goes back to the Industrial Revolution and how people have lost contact with the fruit of their labor, and there's vocational arguments that could be made in there. And I'm not endorsing them. I don't endorse any manifestos. Anytime someone, if you find yourself writing a manifesto, you should go talk to someone. Like it's just not normal.
I was just going to ask, Wade, what do you see as the highlights? What are the real gems that you can take out of Mein Kampf? You know, help us out here.
So I'm not pro manifesto. But in the Steel aspect, though, has brought wonderful blessings too. We see the hurricane in the South. What a blessing that we're able to build many buildings in a way that people can survive through these things. but the germs aspect, maybe you can talk a little bit about, and not in relation to the book, but just historically, I think sometimes we forget what an impact some of the things we do dealing with hygiene and germs has been. I remember as a pastor, when you had babies that were born prematurely, some of the amazing things that nurses and doctors could do in the NICU. But whenever you would go, I remember just having to wash my hands in scalding water for, you know, 2-3 minutes and then wash them again, put gloves on, having to put my hand into the little plastic rubber glove to baptize a little one to bring them into the kingdom of God. But just that washing our hands, what everybody learns in preschool now. Mm-hmm. Not everybody practices because, you know, speaking of going to the gym, it drives me nuts. You go to the gym, you go to the bathroom, you see somebody not wash their hands. And then I watch every piece of equipment they touch, and it just drives me nuts. But, you know, we teach our preschoolers, we teach our little kids, sing the ABCs, wash your hands.
Yeah.
As someone who works with disease or with infectious disease especially, how transformative is this work and these developments that have taken place?
Well, washing the hands is ridiculously a young idea in the world of medical technology. When I'm going to be teaching the nurses about how early or how recent it took to figure out that you shouldn't work on cadavers as doctors and then try to be a midwife or deliver babies, and oh gee, the mom died.
Or work
I wonder
Subway
why.
And make sandwiches.
The idea that diseases that or little things that we couldn't see could cause whole herds of sheep to die or whole amounts of people to die because they drank the water out of one well in the middle of London that had cholera in it is just a huge shift that people didn't really believe in until the turn of the last century. I mean, the 1900s, people were still going, there might be something behind that. And it's really fascinating to realize how long it took to really believe in these things. Viruses, about the 1930s, we had fought a world war, and hadn't really gotten a hold on viruses or really shown that they had really existed or really were things. And that world war had been majorly affected, as the whole world was, by influenza. The Spanish flu is really one of the major reasons that the war was ended, because the Germans ran out of people that were actually fighting or worthy or able to fight. And it changed the world in a horrible way because it was killing the young people. all over the world, and we still don't know why. But there is a couple people, one in Madison, who is working on trying to find out why.
Huh.
And it sounds a little bit mad scientist, but it is kind of important to find out. Most of that work is being done across the border in Canada. So Detroit might be closer to it, actually.
Well, excellent. You mentioned, the washing your hands, and that's always something that so much fascinated me with the Old Testament law. You know, the emphasis on washings that took place. And I think even in the Middle Ages, sometimes you would see in the Jewish community better hygiene, and this reflected itself sometimes in outbreaks of the plague and where they would happen. And then sometimes these crazy ideas, the Jews are poisoning the wells, whatever, because the Jews weren't getting as infected or sick as the rest of the population. And, you look in the people at that time, their mind is not working. I mean, they're doing math in their head. It's just not based in fact or science.
Yeah.
Just the thing we take for granted now that and the difference that it's made, as you said. What about, and now don't scare us too much, but I know you've done some work with or have familiarity with one of the things that, and I think even you mentioned World War One, and we know the things that developed in World War One, which kind of scared mankind enough that we've tried to make some rules about what can be used in war. What about people using disease in warfare? Do you see that as being something that is something we've put in the past or a very real threat?
I don't think it's something we've put in the past at all. There are paranoid conspiracy theories about certain things, but when we go down to it, the Soviet Union, we stopped doing biological warfare with Nixon. It was something very good that he signed and stopped us doing. We did biological warfare defense, but not warfare research. And the Soviets said, haha, good job, and ramped it up. And from the defectors who were in charge of it, they report that there was 80,000 scientists working on biological warfare at any given time in that place, and they were 30 years ahead of us technologically in the biotechnology field. At this point, with some of the new technology, we can easily, if you have a little bit of knowledge on how to grow these things and a little bit of molecular biology, you could easily do some damage. And I've been toying with writing a book, a kind of a murder mystery about that, or at least a mystery in general.
This would be fiction.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Not at all associated with anything like that. But I mean,
first person to die be named Wade.
We could call it the Wade
that
effect,
a great
or
honor.
Wadeism, or Wadeitis.
Do you think? So you're saying this is stuff that individuals with knowledge would be capable.
Individuals with knowledge are capable. Now, the nice thing about
if they had like a blue,
blue
closet
light
or something.
Yeah, no, that's just sterilization blue fields, by the way. Now, the one downstairs, just to be clear, is grow lights for our coral nursery. And that's
so I don't need to
babies,
be that afraid of that one.
Babies,
no.
Nursery.
Baby coral.
Yeah. So it's the second floor is your
office.
The
second floor in one of the labs. I have a background where a back room that has a lot of biohazard signs on it. Wash your hands, use gloves, don't lick this, things like that. And that one has a blue glow that kills the bacteria. So I am not like ground zero of a chlamydia outbreak at a Lutheran campus in Milwaukee.
Well, I'm glad we're trying not to be that. That would be the kind of press we don't need.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep
say, they say there's no such thing as bad press weight. I don't know.
I think that one would be it.
Yeah.
Except asterisk.
Yeah.
Ground zero chlamydia outbreak.
Maybe to get a little bit less serious, and I don't want to make you stay too long. It's getting a little bit late today, and hopefully we can have you back on. A lot of our guests we have on,
fun.
We hope to get multiple times. Just a question I've always had, because a lot of, obviously, my research deals with the Reformation era, and you have the plague outbreaks, things of this nature.
Yep.
And so I read about the plague, and it always seems unpleasant, like universally just unpleasant. But the other one, the modern one that really scares me, is Ebola. That seems extremely unpleasant. If you had to say which one would be worse, you're going to die either way, plague or Ebola.
I think I would choose plague because it would be faster.
It would be. See, I thought Ebola would be faster.
Well, yeah, but you're bleeding. You're having massive...
You're like melting inside.
Yeah,
you're
kind of melting inside. And you're bleeding out of new orifices. People are even described as bleeding from their nipples and vomiting black
That's
blood.
That's unpleasant.
And yeah, it's not great. There was myself and Dean Irby, who is also an infectious disease specialist. When we saw where the Ebola track was going and we knew that it could be transmitted easily into the U.S., we may have a biohazard response kit now that involves full body covers. So if you see me walking around with a full white suit on and a face shield and booties
and
gloves...
I need to go to confession and get...
Yes, make it right with your Lord.
Yeah. One thing I know that you've done for me and a number of colleagues is ruined food. So
you're welcome.
Yeah. If I know, is it Dr. Hackbarth that will sometimes text you? He goes out places and texts you to find out what's wrong with different stuff. I think raw meats.
He keeps sending me very high res pictures of the new pate he ate or the egg emulsion raw meat mixture. And he goes, "Is this safe? How many different things would I die of?" And I've stopped responding. I just look at it and go, "Oh, Steve, how are you still alive?" But he really enjoys. He is a consummate foodie. He really loves it.
Yeah.
He might as well die loving what you do.
Yeah.
I'm going to call it. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Very fun scholar. I got to present with him the other day. It was very fun. But he had told me that, and I kind of got a kick out of it. So I just thought, is there just one food? You know, this is something that people tend to eat and enjoy. One food that comes to mind that maybe you'd like to ruin for us.
Well, this is a Wisconsinite thing. Tiger meat.
We used to have this at seminary.
Okay. Yeah.
Little backstory. So this is a disturbing thing. I'll let you explain what it was.
Yeah.
But I had a classmate who went to go get it for the seminary event that was happening. And after everybody ate it, he admitted he had hit his brakes and it fell on the floor of his car. So it was not only tiger meat, but it had been on the floor of his car. But I'll let you explain what this is now.
Yeah, tiger meat is ground meat raw that you... last time I saw it at St. Patty's Day party, it was just a mound of it, and you have crackers, and you put it on crackers and eat it that way.
Sometimes onions.
Sometimes onions, to add a little panache to it. it's one of the more horrifying things. I haven't been invited back to that St. Patty's Day party because I sat there with my adult drink of choice and stared at it for a long while until they asked me, and I might have launched into a little bit of a sermon there, if you will. But
have you ever tried any?
Goodness, no. The reason being is you can have raw steaks and sear the outside, and in the U.S., for the most part, thanks to the USDA, this is fairly safe. You might
Peter,
get
did
a
you hear that thanks to the government?
The FDA. The FDA is good. We need the FDA. Otherwise, you can go to Mexico and see what happens when you don't have a higher level of standard, even though they try. They do try. It's cultural and societal issues there.
I would believe that. And I tend to, you know, Peter and I sometimes joke we both have libertarian leanings, but I am always grateful for food inspection and the FDA and that. So they make sure it's at least seared so that we're not trapping the disease inside, we're getting rid of it.
But you always think of things that are on the outside. As long as the animal is healthy, the steak seared outside, you're going to kill off the bacteria. But if you grind the meat up, everything is outside. Everything is mixed up, and
there's no inside left.
Especially what they do is they'll have the cows grass-fed for the most part, or the beef, and then the last couple months before slaughter or going shipped off, they'll feed them a lot of corn and grain, and that apparently is where research has shown that you can get The very dangerous E. coli. There's friendly E. coli that you have in your gut, and the ones that have interesting acronyms like EHEC, enterohemorrhagic, and stuff like that. That and Shigella that cause you to, well, release insides out.
Anything hema die. Sounds bad. Even hemispheres, yeah. I'm very leery.
You're not quite sure about that. Yeah, you're uneasy about the northern hemisphere.
Yeah, we're saying this disease is being turned inside out and it's just festering, and then we put onions on it.
Yeah. So
do the onions? Now delicious. They used to think onions.
No, the
did,
onions
did
do not.
Treat
no,
things.
No.
No. Okay.
It might make it more pleasant as it goes down for certain people, and might warn people else off that may try to kiss you at that time and may get the disease. So you're doing them a favor, just
now,
like my
at
shirt.
This party, did any of your family members eat the tiger meat?
No, they will never eat tiger
Is
meat.
Is that because you won't let them? Or,
yes.
So
yes.
They might. Some of them would be willing to try.
I don't know. My,
but
my,
in your vocation as father, you
yes.
prohibit this.
My 2.5-year-old is basically feral at this point. He tends to chew on just about anything. He will chew on bricks of Parmesan cheese and possibly soap from time to time, just to see if it's really changed
his taste.
I used to
have to chew on soap sometimes, too. My mom thought that was a successful treatment for an inner condition I have, which flowed out of my heart and through my mouth. So, in fact, my friends, even neighborhood children, would have to eat soap. She was so effective at treating that condition.
Did parents send them over?
No, just if she heard.
Johnson,
I mean, our houses were about 2-3, you'd have a skinny driveway, maybe 8 feet apart. And so you could hear each other. And, all my good friends lived within hearing distance. So we couldn't get away with much. And it was always, the white bar soap, like Dial or whatever, that tastes the worst.
Yeah.
Like Irish Spring, at least, has a little, what was it, panache, you said? Now I have to imagine that probably is good to eat soap on to help fight disease.
Well, you have a lot of good bacteria in your gut, and we're finding out that it can help against a number of diseases. It can even change your state of mind up in your neurotransmitters in your brain, which somewhat really disturbs a number of us that have studied this but eaten really bad foods. And so... You are what you eat is coming back to roost for us. And we thought, ha ha, that isn't a thing. And now, the gut microflora is a major, major way to protect us against many diseases. And it tends to train our immune system so we don't react against our own self, which is an autoimmune disease, which is bad.
Well, I'm gonna run through a few things I've eaten this week. And maybe, or Peter, you can throw some in. You can tell me safe or not safe. Today we had a parent meeting for Ziggy's baseball team, and they had pizza, and I had some pizza with pepperoni on it. Safe?
Safe.
Yesterday we had the honors welcome dinner, and so Dr. Palmer arranged for us to go to Marty's, and I had lasagna.
Safe.
Safe.
And yummy.
Trying to think. It's been running around a lot this week. Grilled cheese.
Safe.
I did barbecue the other day. We actually had to barbecue twice because, long story, my son decided he was going to... Anyways, we had to grill stuff twice. It got burnt. But and grilled on the grill, cheeseburgers and bacon.
What was the internal temperature of the cheeseburger?
I did not check, but it wasn't pink.
It wasn't pink.
It wasn't pink.
Safe.
Okay, and
what if it's just a little pink?
A little pink is okay. If it is still mooing, that's a problem.
Do you eat yours with? Do you like yours well done?
I always it's hard for
it's
me.
It's the Texan in you, huh?
Yeah, I try to say no, make it medium. It's hard.
They're not supposed to.
What about corn on the cob?
Safe.
Do you have to wash corn on the cob?
Did you shuck it yourself?
Yes.
Safe.
Okay. Peter, you got anything
just
you want to run
by? Just don't eat the worms.
I was watching Rocky the other day, and, he's taking his protein.
Just
raw eggs, glass of raw eggs. So I was trying to work out.
No.
I was doing, is that safe? Or?
No, it isn't, especially if it's in a large industrial kind of
The
egg.
Shell doesn't protect the
No,
inside.
The shell. So I talked to the nurses about this because I want to ruin eating raw cookie dough for them. I grew up on it, but... It turns out that the bacteria can, the chicken has a shared exit for its reproduction and its intestine. Called the cloaca. So
that sounds unpleasant.
Yeah,
but that's so isn't that the Latin term for the bathroom?
Shared
Luther's
sewer.
Tower experience was in
yeah,
the
yeah shared sewer. Yeah. So the salmonella especially can swim up the reproductive tract and get in and around the egg before it's shelled up.
It can be inside too.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be. I read a paper, and it's supposed to be 1 in 20,000 eggs, but one lab 2 years ago for my nursing micro disproved that because we had 7 eggs with salmonella. I should have gone out and bought a lottery ticket, I guess.
What about then, instead of Peter's eggs, protein shakes, like whey protein?
I haven't heard anything bad about it. Just don't drink too much of it. I heard somebody died of it.
Really?
Unfortunately, drinking too much protein shake.
Like not 8 of them or something? Or
yeah, something like that.
Because I heard you don't have to work out if you drink a protein
shake. Oh, really?
That's what I'm working on.
Yeah.
Well, I should try that out.
What about PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon?
That is...
I'm assuming it's safe. It won a blue ribbon.
I'm a Wisconsinite. Anything of that sort should be safe and should be celebrated.
You know, I
however, I'm not... You know, that it's not a bad tasting. It's at least not Miller.
Yeah,
I haven't confirmed this, but I heard that Pabst Blue Ribbon actually didn't win a blue ribbon. It won a medal.
I don't want you ruining the narrative on
like
here, Peter.
This Pabst is, like gold medal, like yeah. Just didn't have the same ring. I don't know. That's what
it's
I heard.
It's big on the coast.
What about Peter? Here is an aficionado of the fine whiskeys.
Oh.
I don't know if the single or the double malts, maybe a triple malt now and again.
Here we go again. We still didn't have this talk.
Yeah, it, whiskey, I mean, assuming you're not drinking to the point of inebriation.
Yeah, safe. It. We
does
always,
it kill germs even?
Oh,
whiskey?
Yeah. Yeah.
What if you poured whiskey on tiger meat?
If you have enough of it sitting there for enough amount of time, I mean, if you're talking about proof, in the lab to in order to increase the killing time of the of the ethanol, which is the alcohol, we won't have 100%. We'll have 70% because it won't evaporate as quickly and it will kill it enough. But if you start diluting it too much, it has less killing power for the bacteria.
So 70% would be in drinking terms 140 proof.
Is for that. Can you find whiskey?
I don't know. I've gotten pretty close. But
well, I do have an idea on this now. It did come up. I asked Dr. Keene, how come theology doesn't get to do labs? And I would like to maybe use your lab for an experiment now. Here's my idea. We have 3 sets of tiger meat. Right? And one set of tiger meat has onions on it. One set of tiger meat gets PBR on it. And then one set of tiger meat gets whiskey of Peter's choice, a fine double malt, whatever the case. I don't know what the malts mean. But, and then we put them under the blue light for, I'm going to say, 3 hours. And then we see which is the healthiest and which... which tastes the best?
So you're gonna taste test it on yourself?
No, students.
Oh, okay.
yeah. What are
well,
they
you're
for
just
anyway?
Gonna have to put past a IRB research ethics.
I'm assuming they can't get drunk off it because the blue light probably would kill the.
You have to talk to Leanne. Somewhere she has just heard this and grabbed her heart.
what if I did it off campus?
It seems like a lot of paperwork. Maybe Dr. Hango could take care of that part for us.
I bet I could do this. I could do this. Does the blue light move? Does it travel?
No, you have to put it underneath the... Because we get a tan and then something called cancer if we put our hands under
it. What's the difference between the blue light and, say, like a PBR neon sign in a bar? Could it function in a similar fashion?
I think we should try that out, too. Now, the thing with your original experiment, we would have to spike it with some as a control to show that we know that there's some bacteria in it. I have some salmonella. We can spike it in, and then...
See, when you were talking spiking, I was getting excited.
You
can,
well, it's a control. I'm a scientist. You have to show that something's there, especially in how much, and then you can put your money where your mouth is.
I could try to publish
then.
On this thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know what? With the salmonella, as long as it doesn't go crazy, I mean, you're going to be worshiping at the porcelain altar for a while. But
well, I'm even thinking, what if we put it on some people's eyes? Maybe this would, with your research, it could align. Maybe there'd be some healing. I have to imagine a lot of the history of dealing with diseases was just putting stuff on stuff and seeing if it's
shaking his head like just stop.
We could talk about a lot of the vaccination ethics on what he did. I mean, with one of the first people who developed the most recent vaccines and it started to take hold, he vaccinated a young child for smallpox with smallpox or cowpox. Was it smallpox, scabs, or something like that? And then he infected the kid specifically with smallpox to
well,
see
that's
if it
not
worked.
Good.
Yeah, it's a little bit. It was a different time. They were really desperate, and it's one of those lenses that we can't really interpret or judge history through because it was a very, very different time.
Yeah. You're not doing that, though, to be clear. You're
no.
not infecting children over there.
No.
Okay, good, good. Well, I'm having some fun, but we should not go too long with the episode. And hopefully, I do think, now you mentioned that, and that brings to mind, I think, talking with you and some of the history of how we've developed for treating with these things and just the ethics of it from that side, too, would be very, very fun.
Yeah.
I guess just any thoughts as we close, Peter or Jim, as we get ready to wind down, anything that you have still you'd like to add it in there?
I don't expect a MMA fighter to go 10 rounds with a professional boxer. However, if everything was turned to MMA file, he would have a problem. So,
and I think I absolutely agree with that one. Peter, anything you want to wrap it up with that's come to mind?
No, but I'm just going to stop eating raw eggs now and have my burgers cooked more. And, you know... This is what happens when I go to the doctor too. I got to stop talking to doctors; they just ruin my
life.
Yeah,
I know. I suggest you just don't go.
We'll find out if the podcasts continue, and if they don't, you'll know why the test turned out in my favor versus wait.
Well, with that in mind, I think you know there's a number of things we could take away from today, but I think especially just the work that Dr. Henkel and those in the sciences are doing on campus here, I find fascinating, especially. How they can do so vocationally with a concern for their neighbor and for others. And so I rejoice in that. And as freaked out as some of our listeners may be after the discussions we've had today, also that we can take great comfort in the fact that God gives us people and materials that we are working with, that in a fallen world where fallen things happen, we still have ways to serve as blessings for others. And that ultimately, no matter what disease or trial may come, we have a Savior who has gone before us through death itself to turn even death to life. And so in that, we find our hope, whatever the case may be. I think it'd be good for everybody after listening today to wash your hands, sing the ABCs while you do so. But also for those of us, we have listeners throughout the world, actually, but those of us who are living in the developed world, to give thanks for some of the things that we see appear in Scripture that people suffered from and struggled with that are no longer prevalent today or in some cases really appearing much at all. And in the meanwhile, as we go forth, as we serve through the various ways God has called us, as school begins tomorrow and I'll be hammering away at theology and philosophy and you will be working on the sciences, ultimately, what's the only thing we can do when it comes down to it, Dr. Henkel?
Let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to count. I don't care what the people are thinking. I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set them up another round. I set them up another round. I set them up another round. One more round won't get me down. And I said, honey, I don't care what the people are thinking.